Hi, everyone. Howdy, I suppose, is more accurate. Let's see. If I remember my password, this will be the hardest part. We live? Presentation? Cool. Well, hi, guys. Thanks for again for having me. My name's Seth Prebatch. I'm the chief ninja of Scavenger and Level Up, and I'm here to talk to you today about something called Interchange Zero. But before we dive into that, I want to give a little bit of background on myself. I had the opportunity to come here last year and talk about this theory of the game layer, basically what it means to take game mechanics from sort of their traditional setting in games in the virtual world, you know, Farmville, World of Warcraft, StarCraft, and move those mechanics into the real world to make life a little bit more rewarding, a little bit more engaging, a little bit more entertaining. And over the last year, a ton of stuff has happened with the game layer. You've probably heard the term gamification maybe even one or two more times than you wish you had. It's kind of gotten a little bit of the runaround. And the reason why it keeps coming up is basically because game mechanics do affect everyday life in a lot of interesting ways, in a lot of ways that you might not naturally expect. But today, I'm actually not going to talk about the game layer directly. I'm going to talk about one very, very cool offshoot of the game layer, one kind of awesome thing that the game layer can be used to achieve that actually ties into how money moves through the economy, how the game layer can affect the economy in a way to pull all of the friction out of moving money and hopefully grow the economy, make money move faster, and achieve all sorts of cool things. And the theory behind that is something called Interchange Zero. And this is kind of a fun topic, so I wanted to start with a pretty simple definition, and then we'll go through it during the rest of the presentation. But basically, interchange zero is the theory that the cost of moving money is eventually going to converge to zero, that it's eventually going to be nothing. And right now, the cost of moving money is anything but zero. If you go to your local coffee shop or a business, or you want to send money to your friends, you spend $10, and some percent of that is frictionally taken away. There's some tax on moving money back and forth. If you use a credit card, it might be 2%. If you send money through PayPal, your friend only gets so much. There's always friction in the economy. And this friction, this interchange, is generally what it's referred to as, you know, when you swipe your credit card or debit card, however much it costs to move the money through that particular system. Right now, interchange is generally anywhere from 2 to 20%. It's always paid by the business, so you as the consumer might not think about it a huge amount. But when you go and you spend $10, anywhere from 20 cents to $2 of that is sort of taken away from the business. And so in the end of the day, you know, you kind of have to pay that. To put some specific examples to this, I grabbed these from a great site called truecostofcredit.com, which sort of shows exactly how much interchange costs you on a daily basis. And this site was put together by the folks from Fee Fighters, who spend a lot of time thinking about interchange, and also by the folks from Freakonomics, who, if you guys haven't read that or heard of it, it's this great group of economists who sort of play with fun social theories and how behavior is affected by econ. So if you look at this, on a daily basis, if you go and buy a pack of gum, and you swipe a credit card to buy that pack of gum, it's costing you about 30 cents extra in interchange to buy that pack of gum. So the gum only costs $1.20, but you have to pay $1.50. That extra 30 cents, that 20%, is basically interchange. It's technically paid by the business, but businesses are smart. The money has to come from somewhere. So in the end of the day, it's paid by you. Then the next day, you go to Jill's Sandwich Shop, which serves great sandwiches here in Austin, and you buy a hoagie for $7, and you're paying about 6.5% extra. What is it exactly? It's 45 cents extra for your sandwich, to be able to use your credit card. And the next day, maybe it's a Sunday, it's Super Bowl Sunday, you order in Super Cheese Pizza delivery for your friends, it's $25, and you're paying $1.13 extra in interchange to be able to get that pizza. Now, all of these numbers seem pretty small, but when you add them up, that's actually $50 billion a year that's spent in interchange. It's $50 billion. And I think we can all sort of collectively look around and say, hey, if I had an extra $50 billion in my pocket, that would probably be a good thing. That would probably be fun. And so interchange zero kind of begs the question, wouldn't it be nice if that were zero, if that were nothing, if there was an extra $50 billion put back into the economy, put back into your pockets, put back into local businesses' pockets? It's all a good thing. But it actually ends up being worth a lot more than $50 billion. Because when you remove interchange from the economy, something really interesting happens. You pull the friction out of the economy. And the only real way to think about this is to look at the last ecosystem that we pulled friction out of. And the last ecosystem that we removed the friction from was the ecosystem of transferring information back and forth. And Al Gore actually invented this ecosystem. He called it the internet. He did a great thing for us, so we all owe Al a round of applause at the end. And by creating the internet, what he really did is he pulled the friction out of information transfer. It used to be really expensive and really slow to move information back and forth. You might have to mail it to someone, you might have to talk to them over the phone, you might have to use what was called a fax machine back in the day to send it back and forth. But suddenly with the internet, you could move information with no friction. You could move it fast, you could move it elegantly, you could move it seamlessly. And because information could flow frictionlessly, there was suddenly a huge amount of extra demand for it. People wanted more information. People shared it more quickly. The rise of social media, all sorts of things that created these new economies because suddenly friction was removed from an ecosystem. Now imagine what would happen if you took the friction out of the economic ecosystem. If you took all of the tax of moving money back and forth, all of the things that slowed money movement out, and you know, just let the economy go loose with a completely frictionless way to move money back and forth with no tax on it. That's what Interchange Zero would be, and it would give us an equivalently internet-sized economic boom, but this time not in the realm of information transfer, but actually in the realm of moving money back and forth. And that would help local businesses make more money, help you save more money, essentially accelerate the economy. So Interchange Zero ends up being something much, much bigger than just not paying to move money back and forth. It ends up being a massive accelerant for the economy. So, Interchange Zero, something good, something we definitely want, can have a really, really big impact. And now the natural question becomes, how do we actually get there? What is the path to Interchange Zero? And the good news is, it's only two steps. The bad news is, they're kind of doozies. The first one is you have to make the costs go down, right? You have to take $50 billion of costs and make them go to zero. And we'll talk through how you do that. And the second thing is, you have to make the revenue go up. Right? You can't just pull $50 billion out of an ecosystem and expect it to keep working. The revenue has to get replaced somehow, but it has to get replaced with a different model. The phrase we sort of use to joke about this is that nature abhors a vacuum and so do bankers. Maybe because they've never used one. But if you pull $50 billion out of something, you know, it starts to become a problem. So these are sort of the two steps to get there, and we're going to dive through those for the rest of the presentation. So step one, bringing costs down. Costs have to go down. You have to move a $50 billion interchange market down to zero, and it essentially happens with one very simple principle, which is that the more competitors there are in an ecosystem, the lower the costs are. Competition goes up, costs go down. And there are two really, really interesting aspects pushing competition up and pushing costs down in sort of the interchange market today. And those two things are technology and also, interestingly, legislation. So we're going to go through how those two have been affecting interchange over the last couple of years. The first thing to know is that this trend of interchange going down is not only brand new, but it's completely against the sort of historical trend of money moving through the economy. Over the last 30 years, interchange has gone in only one direction, and that direction has been up, and the velocity of that direction has been fast. So over the last 30 years, interchange has basically doubled every decade. So it's now, you know, six times as expensive as it was 30 years ago. But now, all of a sudden, interchange is actually going down. It's starting to decrease. And the reason it's starting to decrease is because of competition. Because there are a lot more players that are out there willing to move money back and forth. And with more players doing it, it gets less expensive, there's more competition, there's new technology. And the reason why these competitors have actually just started to come onto the scene is essentially because of a technological shift that opens up the ecosystem. And that technological shift is another one that we've heard a lot about over the last couple of years, and it's mobile payments, but it's mobile payments in a very different way than you normally hear about mobile payments. Mobile payments are important, in my opinion, not because they let you pay with your phone, though that is really cool, at least for sort of geeks like me and geeks like us, that's awesome. But what they're really important is because they open up the ecosystem to allow a whole new breed of payment methods to come onto the market. And with more payment methods, you have more competition. With more competition, you have lower costs. With lower costs, you get closer and closer to Interchange Zero. So the power of mobile payments is actually not paying with your phone, but rather enabling more ways for people to pay with their phones. And let's go through exactly what that looks like. This is the old world, and I call it the old world because it's actually the current world. It just won't exist for too much longer. And the way that it works is that the consumer opens up their wallet. You guys probably do this 10 times a day. You go to a business, you open up your wallet, and you have a pretty limited options, or a pretty limited set of options about how you want to pay, how you want to actually give money to the merchant. And those options are cash, or some non-cash payment method, which is mainly a credit or debit card, and it's one of these four players. It's MasterCard, Visa, Discover, or American Express. And in reality, it's actually only the top two of those. MasterCard and Visa account for 85% of the money that moves through the economy. They are basically the interchange networks that matter. It's a duopoly, so you put money through one of those networks, and the merchant gets money on the other side. I mean, that's what it's been like for the last 30 or 40 years, but it's not going to be like that forever. In the new world, and I'm a big Aldous Huxley fan, so we're going to call it the Brave New World for the moment. In the Brave New World, things operate a little bit differently. The consumer opens up their phone, not their wallet, and then one of these apps, and one of many apps that are going to come onto the scene, enable them to pay in a whole myriad of different ways. So you'll have Dwolla, Level Up, Isis, Google Wallet, Square Card Case, the Starbucks mobile payment app, probably hundreds of others that suddenly open up not just the four payment methods that existed before, but really any set of payment methods. It widgetizes the payment ecosystem. It gives the consumer a huge amount of choice on how they want to pay and takes what was the ecosystem that controlled all of interchange and turns it essentially into an API. So when you pay with your phone, you could use MasterCard or Visa or Discover or Amex to fund your purchase, or you could theoretically have that app use any of a million other payment methods. Maybe it goes directly to your bank account. Maybe it's cash that you've preloaded into it. Maybe it's your Verizon monthly bill. Maybe it's PayPal. Maybe it's your iTunes account. Who knows? But the point is that the phone is greater than a wallet. It's a computer. It allows for the disintermediation, which is a really fun word to say on stage, but for the disintermediation of the payment ecosystem. That suddenly the phone, which is a computer, can route your payment choices to any of a series of competitors. You get consumers with huge amount of choice, and you also get merchants with huge amount of choice, and suddenly this increased competition starts to drive costs down. More competition means lower costs. We have a fun hashtag for this one, which is I took Econ 101 before I dropped out of Princeton. I knew it would come in handy someday. So more competition means lower costs, hashtag Econ 101. And this basically brings to the important result of mobile payments, which is that mobile payments are going to be critical, not because they let you pay with your phone, but because they give you more ways to pay, with your phone. And that's a pretty subtle distinction, but it's critical, because that type of competition is what drives costs down and what lets us get closer and closer to this interchange zero world. Now, new technology is doing a huge part in this, right? Mobile payments are allowing a ton of new competition, but it's also weirdly being aided by the government. The government is actually doing great things to help interchange go down, to help money flow more quickly, to help businesses pay less when they have to move money, and to help consumers save. And it's being driven in large part by this guy, who's, as I said, the most important person ever. So Dick Durbin, if you guys haven't heard of him yet, you probably will hear about him a lot moving forward. He recently passed the aptly named Durbin legislation. He's a very important guy, but maybe not the most humble in the world. And what Durbin legislation does is it starts to fight interchange. It basically reverses what have been 30 years of rising interchange rates, not through the free market forces and the technology and competition, and that's doing a lot of it, but actually by having federal legislation price cap debit cards and break the MasterCard and Visa duopoly. And it's sort of weird for legislation and technology to interplay as well as they are here, but what you start seeing is that first, Durbin legislation put a price cap on debit card charges. And I'll talk through the math of that in a second. They basically made it such that MasterCard and Visa, who are right now the only two people who can process debit cards when you go and pay at a different merchant, now you have to, as a payment processor, offer access to at least four total payment processors for debit cards. So while mobile payments are allowing a competition on the consumer side, what Durbin legislation does is it enforces competition on the merchant side, on the interchange carrying side. And the net result of this is that in the old pricing model, debit cards carried a fee of anywhere from 12 to 22 cents and 1.5 to 3% per swipe. And in the new model, they carry a maximum per swipe fee of 21 cents and a percentage charge of 0.05%. So a drastic drop. And that's a lot of numbers, but to put that into perspective, if you had a $20 transaction on September 31st, before this legislation went into effect, you as a business and you as a consumer would be paying anywhere from 42 to 90 cents in interchange. On October 1st of this past year, when it went into action, Durbin legislation meant that you only paid 22 cents. So a huge drop, in this case not actually brought by the new competition from technology, but actually through helpful legislation to make the market more competitive and really, really decrease costs. This is an incredibly powerful switch, in part because debit cards actually carry no risk. An interesting bit of history for people who maybe haven't spent as much time looking at the credit and debit card networks as I have, I've spent far too much time looking at this, I think, is that about 30 years ago when debit cards were introduced, the banks actually paid merchants to accept debit cards. It was reverse interchange. Debit cards were invented to replace checks. Checks are incredibly expensive for banks to process. They don't want to process checks. And so they invented debit cards, and they'd go to large merchants, and they'd say, hey, when you accept a debit card, I will pay you a percentage of the transaction because you're making my life so much easier. And then about 30 years ago, some very, very clever executives at the banks realized that consumers couldn't tell the difference between credit and debit cards. And while credit cards carried risks, debit cards didn't. But hey, we might as well charge the same for both of them because neither the merchant nor the consumer can actually tell the difference. And suddenly debit cards became as expensive as credit cards, even though they carry no risk. And Dick Durbin came along and said, hey, that's a little broken. I'm going to pass some legislation to both enforce competition and to make them price to the actual risk that's there. So Durbin legislation has had a whole bunch of argumentation around it. A lot of people think it's a good idea. A lot of people think it's a bad idea. In my opinion, you know, in response to sort of the simple question of is this actually good, the answer is yes, probably. That in an instant, Durbin legislation actually did reverse 30 years of rising interchange costs and also opened up on the merchant side a whole new world of competition. All of these things together sort of combine to create more competition. More competition drives costs down. And basically the first step to interchange zero, getting these costs down, is actually already happening with this combination of new technology and new legislation. So really, really cool stuff. So in the path to interchange zero, if you're following along, we've basically got these two steps, which is step one, we have to drive costs down, and that's happening with technology and legislation. And then step two, which is probably the harder part, is you have to find a way to replace the $50 billion of revenue that sort of disappeared when interchange finally hit zero. So we're about 15, 20 minutes in. We've actually already achieved the first half of this, so we're making great progress. And now we're going to dive into part two, which is how we actually find that missing $50 billion and enable the payment ecosystem to continue to function as seamlessly as it's been functioning, but without interchange being a tax on moving money back and forth. So let's dive into step two, bringing revenue up. And the way that we're going to bring revenue up is a very specific example here, but there are a lot of different ways that it can happen. But the example that I want to talk through is how game mechanics can actually help in the transactional world to increase revenue and provide an alternative to interchange. Instead of charging on the margin of I give you $100, I'm going to keep two, actually make it I'm going to give you $100, business, you get to keep the entire $100, and I'm going to use game mechanics to motivate consumer behavior, to use the information in payments to help you make more money, to increase revenue and drive my business model off of that. The fun thing here is when you're a hammer, the whole world's a nail. I spend a lot of time thinking about game mechanics. I'm sure there are lots of other solutions to this as well. But the one I want to dive through is presenting actually a new monetization model for the world of payments driven by game mechanics and behavior shift and leveraging the information in payments as opposed to margin. So on the left side here, you've got the existing model, the interchange model, where you spend $100 at a business, and the business gets 98, and the payment processing ecosystem takes 2. Generally, it's a bit more than 2, but they take some tax on top of that. In the new model, in the interchange zero model, you spend $100 at the business, and the business gets to keep all $100 of that. The money moves frictionlessly. There is no interchange, there is no cost. But in those payments, there's a huge amount of information. And location-based tech has sort of been all the rage here for the last couple of years. So it helps to think about the payment as like a check-in on steroids, right? If you think there's interesting information in a check-in, there is really interesting information in a payment. It's got time, it's got location, it's got context, it's got intent, it's got history, it's got all sorts of cool things. And when you've got this huge wealth of information and you want to motivate some action out of it, making the experience better for the consumer, helping the business make more money, often the missing link between information and action is a couple well-placed game mechanics to motivate that type of behavior. So as we look at this model and as we try and find out how we're actually going to create that green revenue spike, I want to walk through three game mechanics that are particularly well-suited and in fact already being used in the real world to help create that green revenue spike and move us closer and closer to step two of achieving interchange zero. And the three mechanics are the sunken reward, the progression dynamic, and the appointment mechanic. So we'll dive right into these. The sunken reward is actually one of my favorite game mechanics out there because it's a reward that is very different from all other rewards. You guys probably know a fair amount about game mechanics at this point. A normal reward works in that you have some problem, you complete some challenge, you solve that, and then you're granted a reward. So it's essentially you do effort and you unlock a reward. A sunken reward is actually fundamentally different from that. It's a reward where you don't have to do anything to get it. It's sunken. It's just physically at some place, or metaphorically at some place, and once you get there, you unlock the reward. So examples of this in sort of traditional games are in Farmville, the first time you go and visit one of your friend's farms, you get a reward. You haven't really done anything there, but they just want to motivate you to get to that other place, because once you're there, the natural mechanics of being in that place take over. In World of Warcraft, when you explore a new sector, you sort of unlock all sorts of cool things just by making it there, right? It's a sunken reward at a specific place. This doesn't naturally seem like something that might be used in the real world, but there's already a great company based out of Atlanta called Scout Mob who is using the sunken reward plus transactions in the transactional world to help solve one of the big problems with the daily deal market and also help businesses create that green revenue spike off of the information inherent in transactions. So the way Scout Mob works, for those of you who haven't used it before, is instead of a normal daily deal where you buy a deal for $10, for $20, and you go and use it, and we all know that daily deals have a fair amount of problems for local businesses. We've probably all followed that story over the last year. The way that Scout Mob works is that the reward is sunken. You don't have to buy it ahead of time. You don't have to do anything except get to that location, get to the restaurant, get to the cafe. The app is location-based. It knows you're there, and then you unlock the reward, and it's, you know, it's just a discount that's waiting for you there. You put no money into the system, but it's a sunken reward that grants you some incentive for being there. And these types of sunken rewards are actually incredibly effective. It's a new type of you know, monetization model for the payment world that performs a lot better than the existing daily deal models. We've been tracking this type of data through a lot of different merchant partners of ours, a lot of data through Level Up, and have been tracking basically what the lift off of a sunken reward versus a daily deal ends up being. And we talked to Scout Mob about this a little bit, and basically it's a multiplier of, instead of 25% off of a normal daily deal, where if it's 10 for 20, the consumer is expected to spend about 25. The reason why it doesn't end up being much higher is that a weird game mechanic called benchmarking gets triggered, where the game becomes in the consumer's mind, hey, I've spent $10, I've got $20, I want to hit that $20 as closely as I possibly can. If I go too high, well, I'm spending extra money I didn't need to. If I go any lower, well, I'm leaving money on the table, and I shouldn't be wasting that. So people try and hit it almost exactly, but they end up about 25% over. In the inverted deal mechanic, or in the sunken reward mechanic, what Scout Mob and a lot of other companies that are doing this have found out is that there's a multiplier of about 4.7 times. That you avoid the benchmarking mechanic, and that you end up with a consumer interaction that motivates them to actually spend a reasonable amount of money, that's actually more aligned with the business. And this is the first example of how game mechanics can be used in the transactional world to create that green revenue increase just by leveraging the information and payments and the clever application of a few key game mechanics. So this is part one of three of game mechanics that can create that green revenue spike. That one's a little bit involved. So I want to jump back to a simpler one here, which is the progression mechanic. This is a mechanic that you guys probably have experienced 10 times today. It's the most ubiquitous game mechanic on the planet. And just as a quick refresher, the progression mechanic can basically be thought of best as a progress bar. It's a mechanic that's used when you want players to complete, you know, a certain series of actions, and you want them to do something, you know, one time, 10 times, 20 times, whatever it happens to be. This is used, you know, everywhere from World of Warcraft as you're leveling up, to Farmville, to StarCraft, to even LinkedIn. When you log into your LinkedIn page, you'll see the little progression bar, sort of that's always bugging you to actually complete whatever it is that you need to complete to have a, you know, a full LinkedIn profile. With its ubiquity in the gaming world, it's not surprising that the progression mechanic has already been used in the real world and mashed together with transactions a ton. In the real world, the progression dynamic plus transactions essentially ends up being used for loyalty. It is often implemented in the guise of sort of a high-tech punch card. And there are tons of companies out there that are doing this. There's Punched, which just got bought by Google. There's Perka, there's Perkville, there's Perk Street, there's Perkaroo. I think there's even one called Perkaset. For whatever reason, Perk is in all of these different companies' names. And what they basically do is they take this progression mechanic, they bring it into the real world, and they use it to motivate behavior to try and turn the information in payments, how often have you been here, how much money have you spent, to motivate you to come back more often, to reward the consumer, but also to help the business have that green revenue increase off of the information and payments. And again, we've tracked a bunch of data with this, and the progression dynamic in the real world really does create meaningful behavior shifts in the transactional stream that essentially amount to loyalty. This is a graph of one of the businesses whose transactions we've been tracking through Level Up after they put the progression mechanic into place. And what you see is two different segments of customers. At the bottom, there's the blue segment, which is orders each day from repeat customers. And at the top, there's the green segment, which is orders from new customers on that given day. And what you see from the progression mechanic is that it's actually not great at driving in tons of new customers. It's not built to do that. The green lines, you know, they go up, but they're going up because the blue line is going up. They're actually, as an absolute value, not really increasing over this 45-day period. But the blue line, the orders from repeat customers, does increase a ton. The progression mechanic is built to bring customers back again and again and again, and it really can leverage the information in payments to create a behavior shift that ends up making more money for the business and also has a lot of value for the consumer back. So this is the second of three game mechanics that can be applied into the transactional world to create that revenue bump and help move us towards step two of actually achieving interchange zero. We've got one more, but before I go through this, because then we'll sort of wrap up and jump into sort of the summary of how all this plays out, where we are in the presentation is, you know, interchange zero, this really big thing that ends up with frictionless money moving, that enables the economy to accelerate. The two steps that we're talking through are, you know, step one, bringing costs down with increased competition through technology and legislation, and what we're talking about now is sort of bringing that revenue back. helping businesses actually make more money off of it and monetizing the payments world off of that shift. And the final game dynamic I want to talk about for this is my favorite. It's called the appointment dynamic. And the reason why it's so cool is that it's explicitly built to have people take a specific action when some extraneous circumstance might make it such that they wouldn't want to take that action. The most famous example of this is done by Zynga in Farmville, where you have to go back every 6 hours to harvest your crops, otherwise they wilt. And this is actually so powerful that what they found is they can shift that time period from 6 hours and then make it 3 hours, and people will come back every 3 hours, and then make it 90 minutes, and they can actually make it this sort of incredibly frenetic level of activity of people meeting the appointment dynamic to do the thing at the specific time, essentially to avoid their virtual crops wilting. That's the famous example. My personal favorite example of the appointment dynamic is the Tamagotchi. Total throwback here. I don't know if any of you guys remember the Tamagotchi, but I love this thing. It's a little virtual creature who lives in your keychain, and you have to feed it and clean up after it and do all sorts of silly things. Otherwise, it will die after a certain period of time, and then it's very sad, and your parents won't buy you another one, and it just ruins the whole family vacation. So the Tamagotchi is a great example of the appointment dynamic, and it's used in games all over the place. But the appointment dynamic is also being used in the real world. And the best example I could find of the appointment dynamic in the transactional world to help businesses make more money is another great company called ThinkNear. And what they've done is they tap into businesses' point-of-sale systems and they track order velocity. They see how fast orders are coming through at any given point of the day, and then they map that to sort of extraneous things that might be affecting it. So orders might be particularly high on one day, and they know that there's a game going on in town. Or orders might be particularly low, and they know that there's a game going on elsewhere, and people are at home watching. Or it might be raining, like it was yesterday, and people just don't want to go outside, and so orders are very low. Or it might be specific times of day. Whatever it happens to be, they map all that, and they create incentives. They create appointment mechanics, which basically bring people in to normalize traffic at those specific times, to help the business make money off of those dead times, and also have them, sort of deal with their fixed costs. Because if you're a restaurant and you've got empty seats, you can't ever get that money back. This type of appointment mechanic is going to be really, really effective, and for ThinkNear has been really, really effective. We played around with one of the specific things they do, which is the effect of rain on transactions. And we tracked a bunch of businesses through Level Up in Philadelphia over about a 90-day period, and what we learned is that restaurateurs in Philadelphia absolutely hate the rain. And the reason they hate the rain is that no one goes outside and no one comes to their businesses. And what you see here is a graph with two different series. You've got the red series, which is the number of orders on any given day, and the blue series, which is the inches of precipitation. And you can see a pretty clear inverse correlation between how much it's raining and how busy these set of businesses are. Now, what's not shown here, which is also fascinating, is that even though the order volume drops by about 20% on days when it's raining, the average ticket price goes up by about 12%. So fewer people come in, but they spend more. We did a bunch of surveys to try and figure out why it was that people were spending more, and it was one of two things. One was sort of order compression. You'd be at an office and someone would say, oh, it's raining, hey, intern, why don't you go out and get the food? And so they'd have a slightly larger order and the intern would be wet, but everyone else would get to stay dry. The other thing that happened was people sort of rewarded themselves. They were like, hey, like I have just achieved a sort of Lord of the Rings style epic mission to get through this like absolute rain torrential downpour. So I'm going to, I get the extra cookie, right? I get that. That's my reward. But whatever it is, that's what's happening. And so companies like ThinkNear are leveraging the appointment mechanic to normalize the transaction volume for businesses, to be sort of shielded from these extraneous events. And again, using the information in payments to not tax the business on moving money back and forth, but create a really monetizable revenue increase by helping that business make more money off of the information in each of their payments. Really, really cool stuff. And that basically leads us back to how revenue can actually go up and how you can have a payment ecosystem continue to function when interchange, a $50 billion industry, disappears. Because you're no longer taxing on moving money back and forth, but you're actually aligning with businesses using this huge trove of untapped information, maybe combining it with some clever game mechanics, but again, there are other ways that you can monetize it, and creating that green revenue increase and having an industry that monetizes off of a lift in revenue as opposed to a tax on revenue. And that's the really, really powerful sentence for sort of step two, that it's a complete inversion of the payment ecosystem, that marginal models, interchange models are going to go away, and it's all going to be about how you can help that business succeed more, and the more you can make them succeed, the more you get to monetize off of that. So as a quick recap, how to achieve interchange zero in two easy steps, or at least two steps, maybe not so easy. Again, interchange zero, the theory that the cost of moving money eventually converges to zero, that this tax, this friction in the economy eventually goes away. When that happens, the economy gets to move faster, you get this huge accelerant, and the two steps to get there are one, pulling the costs out of the ecosystem. New technology is enabling us to achieve that. New legislation is enabling us to achieve that. And while it's still very early days, that's actually already starting to happen. So there's real progress there. And step two is replacing that $50 billion industry, that marginal tax on the economy, with something that actually helps revenue go up. By leveraging the information and payments, by using game mechanics cleverly to help businesses grow and monetizing off of that revenue increase. And as those two things happen, interchange will converge to zero. And sort of with that, interchange zero is coming. And thank you guys for your time, and would love to answer any questions. So if there are any questions, I think there is a microphone. I actually can't see. I'm kind of light blinded, but I think it's maybe right over there.
Hi. All right. So, in that interchange zero scenario, what does a company like how does a company like ThinkNim make money? Where exactly is its revenue?
Sure. So, again, I'm commenting sort of in theory here. I don't know ThinkNim's exact revenue model. But the way that I imagine it happens, and the way that I figure it will happen in the future, is that they basically can go to that business, and by tapping into their point of sale, by tapping into their payment flow, use these mechanics, use these incentives they create to drive in new customers. There's direct attribution there because they're actually tied into either the point of sale or into the customer attraction with whatever incentive they're doing. And they can go back to the business, and I know that they show businesses these dashboards where they say, hey, on this rainy day, we drove you 50 new customers, or 50 customers that we drove to you, who spent $500. That's marginal revenue that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And so we're going to charge you 20%. Right, much higher than the 2 or 3% interchange, we're going to charge you 20% on that revenue. But there, it's a revenue lift that they're monetizing off of. And businesses and people in general are much more willing to pay a higher percentage of a revenue increase than they are in revenue that is rightfully theirs. You know, if I go to you and say, hey, I already owed you $10, but in order to hand it to you, I want 2%, you're going to be a little bit annoyed. But if I go to you and say, hey, I can get you $20, but can I have half of it? That's a much more interesting business proposition. And that's essentially what ThinkNim and a lot of these other companies doing that are relying on, the revenue increase and taking some percentage of that, or conversely charging some sort of monthly fee to be able to offer that service. But it all boils down to monetizing off of the revenue increase. Thanks.
So in the current system, it seems that the banks provide two primary things. One, the secure storage of funds and some method to transfer it securely. And in the other case, they provide protection against chargebacks. How would you propose that those things are handled in your new model?
Sure. So great question. And for those who didn't hear, it was sort of a two-part question. One is banks are providing two services. One is secure storage, and one is protection for the consumer and chargebacks. The interesting thing that I think will happen here, and I'm actually just going to jump back to that slide because it'll make it easier to showcase. Here we go. Right now, I would actually say that banks are providing those services and one other key service, which is actually moving the money back and forth. That without them, you can't actually move the money. I think the two services that you've mentioned probably won't go away. That the credit component of credit cards will probably stay around for a very long time. And in that way, actually, Amex and Discover are much more insulated from this shift than a lot of other players because they provide those absolutely very rich and valuable services on top of it. They know how much credit to offer someone. They offer secure storage. They offer protection. They offer chargebacks. They offer all these interesting fraud services. And I think that will make them an incredibly compelling funding source forever moving forward. The part of their business and the part of the MasterCard Visa business which will go away is the monopoly on being the mechanism of transfer. So what I imagine is these middle players will be able to interface with all of these different funding sources, and consumers will have a lot of choice, and consumers very well may say, hey, I want to stick with my American Express card. It's not the only way I can pay anymore. I have the choice to pay with lots of different mechanisms, but American Express offers me all sorts of value on top of the payment, and that makes me worth, the credit they offer me, the Amex points, the concierge service, whatever it happens to be. I don't have an Amex, so I don't know. I have a debit card. The concierge service, all that stuff makes it worthwhile. And I think that they actually will, those services will continue to exist, but the critical underpinning of just moving the money back and forth will be sort of disintermediated from that ecosystem.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm also very excited about the transaction costs going to zero. I'm not convinced that we need to replace that $50 billion because that money's still in the economy. It's just now on the consumers and business side instead of on the financial services side. So I wonder whether step two is actually necessary for any of this to happen. The other thing that I'm kind of interested in is whether there's this whole other aspect of ways that this information could be valuable, namely either selling that information directly or using it for marketing and advertising.
Sure. So great questions. I'll tackle them in order. So the first part of sort of why that $50 billion needs to get replaced, you're correct. The $50 billion isn't actually, well, it is going somewhere. It's going somewhere very good, right? It's going back into the local businesses and back into the consumers' pockets. The reason why it's important for it to be replaced is that there still needs to be an infrastructure, right? Someone does need to support actually the facilitation of money going back and forth. And the people who do that right now are MasterCard, Visa, Discover, Amex, and the payment processors. And they're willing to do it because they get paid $50 billion a year. Now, whoever's going to take that over, and it's not going to be one person, it's going to be a whole series of new options, there does need to be money for them to provide what is a valuable service, right? The digital moving of money back and forth. So there needs to be some way for them to make money. But the thing that I find, you know, particularly critical about it is the way they make money has to be in, you know, aligned with the incentive of interchange zero and therefore aligned with the incentive of the business. So they just have to be much more creative. They have to come up with new ways to take that information and make money off of it so that they can essentially support themselves moving the money back and forth. And it suddenly becomes this interesting competitive ecosystem where the company that gets to move money back and forth is not MasterCard or Visa, who simply just has the monopoly on it, but the company that can actually add the most value back to the business in the process of moving the money back and forth. And that's very cool, and that's why I sort of always include that step two, that something does need to replace it. It's not that the money's disappeared, it's that someone needs to pay the gatekeepers. The second question is, you know, are game mechanics, essentially could be, are game mechanics or is this sort of revenue increase from game mechanics the only way to replace that money? And the answer is absolutely not. You're totally correct. It can be done in a whole bunch of different ways. Some of them are going to be scarier to consumers than others. I think the idea of a payment network, and again, in this model, right, the consumer has sort of infinite choice. So the payment networks are suddenly beholden to the consumer as opposed to the bank, which is interesting. And if a payment network came out and said, hey, you know, merchants, I offer very cheap interchange rate, but consumers, I'm going to sell your data, people would probably not choose that payment method, right? They might get a little bit creeped out, rightfully so, and they might choose to go with something else. So there is some informational model that probably does work, but it's going to be a fine balancing act of adding value back to the consumer and privacy. There are other ones which have to do with just business intelligence. You know, it may be that all of these strange loyalty systems that have come into place that are outside of the payment, Paytronics, a whole bunch of different ones, suddenly flow back into the payment, and it's really just the business being able to learn about their customers. I mean, that's something that they're actually willing to pay a payment processor for. It's not just game mechanics. Again, that's something that I spend a lot of time focusing on, so if you're a hammer, the whole world's a nail, which is why I sort of talk about it a lot. But you're totally right that it could be many different things.
Thanks.
John Kenny, Draft FCB. Big fan of payment systems adding value versus extracting value. Question is, the incumbents, they're already sitting on vast amount of data. Do they have an unfair advantage in being kind of first to market to utilize this data to add value?
Totally. So great question. Again, if anyone couldn't hear, it's about sort of do the incumbents have an unfair advantage because they've already got all this data? Short answer is yes. Incumbents almost always have an unfair advantage. They also have something, you know, very difficult to deal with, which is sort of the innovator's dilemma. That while the incumbents technically could do, you know, on a pure technical level, everything that I've just talked about in terms of leveraging game mechanics to add value back, in terms of the previous question about using that information to help sell advertising or marketing, they could do all of these things. They've got one real issue that makes it tricky, which is the innovator's dilemma. That if they go out and they say, hey, we made $50 billion on interchange last year, but you know what? We've actually found a better business model. It can be a bigger business model. And so we're going to drop our interchange rates to zero and shift to this. They could do that, but man, that is scary for a big company to do. It's really, really hard. Companies have done it. If you look at IBM and what Lou Gerstner did, there's a great book on this called Elephants Can Dance. If you want to read about a company actually doing this correctly, it's amazing what Chrysler did with Lee Iacocca and shifting their entire business model. It has been done, but it's incredibly difficult, and particularly in these organizations where they're super cash rich, and in order to shift, they will instantly cost themselves money. As they figure out how to replace that money with something new, it becomes very difficult for them to do. And so I think it really is the job of you know, technological innovators, the people who come to this conference, to find ways to make that happen and rebuild the economic infrastructure and sort of unseat these guys as sort of a critical part of Interchange Zero actually happening.
Hi, I work for not-for-profit financial alternatives, credit unions. Credit unions were actually exempted from the Durbin Act because
totally.
Actually debit cards have tremendous amount of risk. There's the huge amount of fraud and loss that happens in that area. And when this model was adopted in Australia, they found that consumer prices actually rose. They did not fall as people had been led to believe. So my question is when you have smaller players in the market that are not-for-profits, where every dime goes back to the people who have created that cooperative financial structure, when you have those players in the market, how are they going to exist in a system where there is no interchange, where interchange supports things like free access to your money, free access to checking, free lower loan rates, higher deposit rates? How do they survive in the model that you're describing?
Sure. So great question. And one of the key parts of this, which is something that I didn't mention about Durbin legislation, but is totally accurate, is that these debit card price changes do not affect either credit unions and also don't affect banking institutions with less than $10 billion in assets. Now, the vast majority of debit card transactions, something about, I think it's like 80 to 85% of them are affected by Durbin legislation, but credit unions, et cetera, aren't. The reason they're not, and again, I think this is actually a testament to the government doing things right, is that, as you mentioned, credit unions really do add a huge amount of value. They are not doing any type of predatory pricing on interchange. They're helping, you know, they're cooperatives. They're putting the money back into the hands of the stakeholders, of the credit holders, which is part of the reason why they're exempted, and I'm pretty confident will continue to be exempted forever moving forward. They are economically very valuable assets for the community. How they exist moving forward, I think, is in much the same way that they exist now. The transition will be shielded from them for a little bit because of Durbin legislation handling them correctly. And also, the value that they add back to the community is something that, whether it's being paid for by a consumer swiping and having 2%, or actually paid for by the consumer directly, or paid for in some other way, it is a service beyond the movement of money that adds a huge amount of value. Things like you said, free access to checking accounts, you know, being able to see your money online, all of these things which are important for consumers and are actually value-added services beyond the core atomic unit of just moving a dollar back and forth. And what I think the vision for Interchange Zero ends up being is that the friction of that atomic unit goes to zero. The value-added services and the things like credit unions that create those in really sort of healthy, sustainable ways for communities absolutely still play a role, and I don't see them going anywhere.
My question was mostly already answered, but I wondered if the $50 billion that you spoke of, is that all debit cards?
No, the number itself is often hard to come by. It's you know, ranges estimate from you know, $50 billion to $100 billion. It's a very, very large number, but it technically includes both debit and credit cards. And I think that Durbin legislation has done a great job of starting to move the debit card needle. There's still a huge amount to be done in the credit card world. You guys probably, you can look this up afterwards. It's quite fun. But depending on what credit card you have and depending on where you use it, there are about 600 different interchange rates for every different major credit card provider. So the credit card side of the equation is not only expensive, it's also so intensely complicated that most merchants just really have no idea what's going on and just end up saying, hey, this is going to be expensive. I'm going to have to raise my prices and charge the consumers a bunch. So right now that is both. But I think Interchange Zero will probably be most effective on the debit card part of the world first, but is absolutely going to apply to everything as we move forward.
How do you see it applying to the credit? You know, because it's not cash that people have readily available.
So the credit-added service, on top of moving money back and forth, is going to be something that people will have to pay for forever. It's a service beyond just moving money back and forth. But that component of the financial ecosystem is actually a separate amount of money. It's separate from interchange. So this $50 billion includes the money that they charge to move the money back and forth. It does not include the fees that an American Express, or American Express is different because you have to pay your balance every month, but that a Visa or MasterCard impose when you're late or for extending credit. That's actually a completely different pile of money. And I don't think that pile of money is going anywhere.
Right.
Offering credit is actually a very useful value-added service. It's just not the core atomic unit of moving money back and forth. I would liken that to, if you want the fun internet analogy, credit cards are Hulu or Netflix, right? It's something you're actually willing to pay for because you're getting information beyond, you're getting some value beyond just the transfer of information, whereas interchange should be Google or YouTube or Twitter, right? Something where just moving information back and forth should and naturally will be free. Money is just information. If you want something beyond that, that's a totally chargeable value-added service.
That's a good analogy. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Seth. I'm Barney Pell with QuickPay, a mobile parking payments platform. So
Oh, cool.
Parking, but payments specialize in that. A great talk, and I totally am excited about this disintermediation happening and, you know, the actual transaction charges handling down to zero. These things really crush merchants, and we lose a lot of money on it. In order for that to happen, you talked about competition. In these intermediating players like mobile wallets, of which you have one and we have one, as long as the customers are ultimately paying for those wallets with credit cards, then the costs don't actually go away. So the only way to really get those, you know, even if you're doing prepayments or something like that, and that's still coming from a credit card, they don't go away. So to get those card charges away, you actually have to have in the wallet linked to a payment that actually goes to someone, not a credit card company, like a bank, okay, so that you can probably do that. So the first question is, how do you see the critical mass happening where there is enough accounts where the charge is going through banks that finally we can, you know, the actual wallets can exert enough influence to remove the actual transaction charges? And I have a second question after that.
Sure. So great question. Initially, when you're using a mobile wallet and you are just linking a card, you definitely have, you know, the base costs of that credit card transaction or that debit card transaction, though there are some things that you can do. In the Starbucks mobile payment app, for example, you preload money. Now, consumers don't like preloading money. There are other ways to buffer transactions that are a little bit more complex but less annoying to the consumer than that. But to go through the Starbucks example, because they've done it quite successfully, Starbucks actually, in large part, created their mobile payment app and created their whole loyalty program because when you buy a $5 coffee, you're paying 30 cents in the swipe fee, and then, you know, 2 to 3% on the actual transaction. And that 30 cents ends up being 6% on a $5 transaction. Whereas if you're loading $50 onto the card ahead of time, well, then you're only paying that 30 cents once. You're still paying the 2 to 3%, but that 30 cents goes from being 6% of the transaction to less than 1% of the transaction. So that's one of the ways that it starts to play out. The more interesting way that it starts to play out is exactly what you mentioned, that alternative payment methods, things like Dawala, things like linking to your bank account, things like carrier payments, things like PayPal or Verizon, start to gather steam. And they already have. There's already huge amounts of money moving through these alternative payment methods. As the consumer choice becomes available, people will switch. And it's not that everyone has to switch. It's that people starting to switch creates the competitive pressure that suddenly, in the minds of Amex, MasterCard, Visa, and Discover, they say, hey, why is less money moving through my ecosystem this year than it did last year? Why less this month than it did last month? Because people are starting to choose alternative payment methods because it's better for the merchant. Maybe the merchant's offering something. It's better for the consumer for whatever reason. And it's that type of competitive price pressure that creates competition, right? That moves costs down over time. And it's certainly not a 100% shift, but it just has to be enough for people to start feeling a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of anxiety about where this money's going. And then it starts the snowball, which is what a truly free market, frictionless economy creates just this time in the payments world.
Great. And then my second question, I saw that Level Up announced that you had gotten a very low low transaction charge you could pass on to merchants if they participated. So I'm curious about how you did that, how a startup goes and leverages the credit card company to get the best possible rates.
Sure. So this is one that I'll actually probably take offline with you because this is not the not the environment for me to pimp Level Up. But the 2 second version on it is that Level Up has a payment processing rate which is 2%, which is a lot low, no swipe fee, which is a lot lower than a lot of interchange rates. In fact, most interchange rates. And we've done some clever things to really start this process, to start being one of the players that puts competitive pressure on the environment. We believe in this theory very deeply, and so we sort of put our money where our mouths are to try and make that happen. But I'll connect with you afterwards, and we can talk about that
sure.
In more detail.
Thanks.
Hi there. My name is Anurag Gulati. The question that I have for you is, so let's say we go to this model where we don't charge transactions anymore, and we raise, let's say we get, you know, $30 more per person. So now we say to one merchant, we say we want half, and that merchant agrees. But then another merchant, we say we want, you know, half, and they say no, we'll give you 20%. How do you actually scale this on a global, platform?
So great question. And it essentially boils down to what happens when there is this revenue increase and there's a lot of competition for who will do that cheaper. I mean, the answer is that's great, right? That's exactly what you want. That what ends up happening in a natural, completely unencumbered free market economy is that whoever can do it best gets the ability to move the money for the merchant. And best might be cheapest, right? If you had two players and they both said, hey, I'm going to get you exactly $100 extra and I'm going to get you exactly $100 extra, but mine costs you $50 and mine costs you $25, any natural business owner is going to go with the one who costs you $25. That's exactly how the world should work. But it might be slightly more complex than that. right? It might be that this one is going to get you $100, but it's not as good an interface. There's not as much information in it. It's not as elegant an experience. Consumers don't use it as much. It doesn't have the scale, whereas this one does, right? There are all sorts of different things that suddenly then move, and this is exactly what I want to happen, right? That move the conversation from, hey, you have to use MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and American Express because there is no other, so I get to charge you whatever I want, to, hey, merchant, you have all of these choices about what you want to be leveraging to increase revenue, and they're all different. Some have lots of consumers, some might not. Some might use different technologies, some might use NFC, some might use QR codes, some might use SMS, some might use ultrasonic signals, doesn't matter. But suddenly it's not only choice on the consumer side for what payment method I want to use, but choice on the merchant side for what I want to be leveraging to create that revenue spike. And whoever does it best gets the right to move the money back and forth. And that's the really, really cool inversion that Interchange Zero moves. It's all about rights, not actually that's what you have to use.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Wallace with Pitney Bowes, and we are stewards of a vast amount of transactional data, regardless of who the gatekeeper is. My question is more on your gaming theory. When you're looking at the rewards back or the appointment concept, are you looking at that consumer as an individual gamer with an individual ID, or are you looking more at brands throwing things at a segment, like anybody that's in this area on this day?
So great question. And it could be either. There are some game mechanics that are suited for the individual. You know, if you've got a progression mechanic going on, that's very much, this merchant is trying to reward me for specific actions. And what's nice about that is it's game mechanics, but it's totally transparent. I mean, one of the things that I often get asked about is sort of when game mechanics move from being motivating to manipulative. And the difference is transparency, right? And in the payment world, there's a lot of, you just have to be transparent, otherwise the thing is completely broken. But so in the progression mechanic example, that's a very individual, transparent motivation. It's, hey, I want you to come back to my location as opposed to any other location, and I've got this game, I've got this reward that you can have. In other examples, like the appointment dynamic with ThinkNear, there it is very much what we would call sort of cohort targeting or demographic targeting. It's, I need to attract new customers, and I want to do it from anyone within this segment on this given day. And so there it might be based on demographics, it might be based on cohort. It's sort of the merchant not saying directly to this consumer, hey, do this, but saying to the world, hey, we've offered this incentive. And I really think that we'll see examples playing out on both fronts, and I think both fronts have value and should work in different cases, but equally as well.
Hi, I'm Josh Kramer, and I took Econ 101. And
I didn't see you in class. That's so weird.
Well, yeah, which it was microeconomics, right? So I believe that you can incentivize me to come and buy a cookie from you when it's raining. But I also took Econ 102, which is macroeconomics.
And, I didn't get that far.
And there's something you should know about me. I am only, in my budget only affords me one cookie per week.
Okay.
And so because I came in and bought the cookie from you when it was raining, now later in the week when it's sunny, when I would normally come and buy my cookie from you, well, I can't afford to do that because my budget doesn't allow me.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, you know, do you really believe that these game mechanics will increase spending on a macroeconomic level with other macroeconomic forces at play that may be suppressing the global spending? And what theories would you have that might support the overall increase in spending up to $50 billion, like you mentioned?
Sure. So this is a great question. And it essentially can be restated as sort of, if you create a compression in spend, is there a natural elongation of future spend? Do people spend less in the future? And weirdly, I guess not weirdly, but the data that we've seen suggests that doesn't fully happen. It absolutely does happen to some degree, right? There are going to be people like you who say, I have a budget of one cookie per week. I'm not breaking that. Even if the cookie monster shows up and I've already eaten the cookie, like, we're done. Right, that's all the cookies we've got. But there are other people who sort of do fall into this, and the economy in general falls into this sort of rising tide phenomenon, where as people spend more money, money moves more quickly through the economy, there's an increased velocity, and the actual total spend, the total tide, does lift. I mean, this is a sort of natural Keynesian theory of economics, right? That if you're in a recession, the government spends more, that creates more money moving through the economy, increases tax revenue, government can continue to spend more. It doesn't always work, but there certainly isn't a zero-sum game within the economy. And so you can create these compressions in spend, which will absolutely have some cannibalistic effect. Some people who are motivated to spend on this day will not spend on the next, but other people will spend on the next. And the reason they might spend on the next is because that money went somewhere. It went to the merchant, and the merchant might now be busier, and I might have to hire another person, which puts more money back into the economy. And essentially, these mechanics don't create a zero sum pulling money away from day A and moving it to day B, but rather an increase in the velocity of money, which can actually create a larger economy without more money totally being in the ecosystem. It's an interesting sort of micro look at a larger economic theory of basically Keynes from 40 years ago.
We'll know if Keynes is correct in a couple of years if we see if we make it out of this recession then. So.
Hi, my name is Drew, and this may just be more my misunderstanding than what you said. I don't really understand the assertion that debit cards carry no risk. Like, I live in LA, and my card gets stolen all the time. How, in your new ecosystem, and the fraud and the investigation, the 1-800 number for me to call, that costs money? How does your system take into account all that?
Sure. So that's a great question, and it's not you misunderstanding at all. It's actually just a slightly different definition of the word risk. So let me just pull this up. So you're correct that to say debit cards carry no risk is in the global definition of risk is incorrect. What I mean by debit cards carry no risk is that they carry no credit risk. In a credit card, you are explicitly extending money to the consumer that the consumer does not have. In the debit card world, you're not. They're doing a check against your bank account, and they're saying, does this consumer have the money? And if they do, then we can spend it, and if they don't, then we can't. And that exact point you made about credit cards being stolen and fraud and theft is exactly why in Durbin legislation, there's still a 0.05% transaction fee on the total dollar volume. Durbin actually wanted it to be zero. And the big credit debit card companies, banks came back and said, hey, that's really not fair because there actually is some risk, not credit risk, but there's theft and fraud risk. And so Durbin eventually, had to bend and say, okay, you know what, there is some of that risk, but that risk, and they dug into the numbers, and there's some really interesting studies on this online. Durbin legislation is like this 2,600-page monstrosity, but if you get a chance, like it's actually fascinating reading. I'm a geek. I'm sorry. anyways, they go through sort of how the risk breaks down, and they basically determined that that type of risk accounts for about 5 basis points on a transaction, and everything else was fluff. Everything else was carryover from the credit risk. So it does exist, but it's just much, much smaller, and so you can really compress it down.
Hi, thanks for sharing a great presentation. I was hoping you could help clarify for me. It seems like you structure the problem as being moving the money, and I would potentially argue that none of the card networks move a dime. They really move. They do the authorization and kind of the real-time data stuff, and actually they never really touch a dime of the money. So to me, potentially the problem isn't moving the money. It's more the authorization and really the real-time authorization. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So I think that's all part of the part of the larger part of moving the money, right? You can't move money without knowing that this person has the money to move, and that this is where you're going to send it. But those types of networks, the actual infrastructural cost of maintaining that in the age of the internet is a lot lower than it used to be. The costs have gone up, but the costs have dropped tremendously. The costs to use the network have gone up, but the costs of maintaining the network have dropped tremendously. It used to be a physical network. I mean, interchange was actually literal wires that connected different banks, and there were 7 different hubs, and interchange sort of moved through that. Now in the age of the internet, obviously you need to handle security correctly, but there are models that enable you to do this over the web. Most of the money is already moving over internet connections, IP-based banking, as opposed to this sort of network system. And so it's basically what Interchange Zero does is it breaks the facade of that monopoly that says, hey, even as our costs have gone down, our revenues have gone up, and says, no, as costs have gone down, there should now be additional competitors who can do all of the things that you do around authorization, around moving the money, but they're just leveraging the new infrastructure, as are you, but because they're able to now compete with you, they can just do it much, much cheaper.
We have time for one more question.
Cool.
Hi, Seth. I'm one more question.
Make it very hard.
I don't think it's that hard, but I'd be interested to hear what you think. I don't really know that much about what you're talking about, but I find it fascinating. But here, my question is, I think, in the world that we live in, we have so many choices already, and there's sort of that paralysis of choice in some instances. And I'm wondering how you see it playing out when the merchant has a choice and the consumer has a choice, I think part of the reason that Visa and MasterCard do as well as they do or have for so long is their ubiquity. I know if I have a Visa or a MasterCard in my wallet that it's going to work anywhere I go, any time of day, anywhere I want to buy something. Part of the reason that Discover Card has struggled at times. So I'm wondering how you see that influx of choice, both on the consumer and on the merchant side, sort of sorting itself out?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And there are actually two parts of it. So one is the ubiquity question. And this is particularly interesting to me because any payment network that wants to sort of start up is going to have a real problem of ubiquity. Right, and if that doesn't work, then you really do have an entrenched monopoly. I mean, it's a natural monopoly because they've built out the infrastructure and no one could possibly touch it. The good news is that there actually are a bunch of case studies for new payment networks that only work in certain places already starting to get traction. And the best one is the Starbucks mobile payment app. Right, that is a way to pay with your phone that explicitly only works at Starbucks locations. Now, Starbucks is a very special company. Right, they own all of their stores. They've got a great brand. They've got huge user base. But they're doing about 26 million mobile payments a year, and it only works at Starbucks. And yet, people are willing to use it. So there's some example of that starting to happen. And more interestingly, if you look back 30 years, the largest credit card network was Sears. And Sears had a credit card that only worked at Sears, but people were willing to adopt it even if it only worked at that place. So ubiquity, there actually are case studies and there's sort of historical precedent for that starting to work. As for the question of sort of paralysis of choice, I think what you'll start to see here is in those mobile wallets, people will build smarter and smarter algorithms to take the choice away from the consumer. You could imagine an algorithm, a mobile wallet app, that makes its play for consumers to use it as, hey, put in all of your payment methods and I will know where you're going to pay and I'm going to route the payment to the card that's going to give you the best rewards for that. So I know that your Chase card has 3% cash back at Home Depot, and you just paid at Home Depot. So even though Amex is your default, I'm going to move it to your Chase card. And you can imagine all of these very clever sort of personalization algorithms being built into the mobile wallet that might optimize to the consumer or might optimize to the merchant. Might say, hey, you know, put this in help the local economy mode and let me pay this merchant with the payment method that's actually going to save the, that's actually going to make sure that most of my money makes it to the merchant. And so I think there will be a paralysis of choice up front, but as these things move on to essentially computers in our pockets, there will be really, really clever startups that tackle that problem with clever algorithms to make everything just work for the consumer. Cool. Thank you, guys.